Shockwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Susan Minot, whose latest novel is 30 Girls. Susan Minot is also the author of several novels, short story collections, a mixture of the two for Monkeys, Lust and Other Stories, Folly, Evening, Rapture, co-author of two screenplays, which I want to talk about. One is Stealing Beauty with Bernardo Bertolucci. The other is Evening with Michael Cunningham, which is a screenplay of her own novel. 30 Girls concerns 30 girls who were abducted in 1996 by members of the Lord's Resistance Army, led by Joseph Kony, in Uganda. And I understand that the origins of the book go back to the research behind a story you wrote in 2000 that was supposed to be in Harper's, but there was a similar story, so wound up getting published by McSweeney's. So let's go back a little to that. Did you go to Uganda at that point?
I did. I went in 98. I was spending some time in East Africa, and I had already planned to go back from New York, where I lived, to Kenya. And I heard a story from a woman at a dinner party in New York City who was a guest from Uganda. And she told the story of these girls being kidnapped from their boarding school in northern Uganda, run by Catholic nuns, and led off into the bush. And one of the nuns decided to go after and try to bring them back.
And that was essentially, so you went over there, you checked it out, you toured around Uganda, toured around Kenya, and you wrote this article about it. But then I guess it kind of died for you, except Kony remained in your brain, and of course later on we'll talk a little bit about Kony fever in the United States.
Kony not only remained in my brain, he remained very active in the North. At that time he had been terrorizing this very poor agrarian area of northern Uganda and ransacking small villages with thatched huts, stealing the children, killing the parents, and sort of enslaving these children in what he was calling an army, with a group that he was calling rebels, but it was really more like a sort of cult-like enslavement.
The character of Jane in 30 Girls interviews several of these girls. Did you do those interviews?
I did interviews like that, yes.
And that must have been quite a shocker, because I understand that it wasn't Kony that kept coming back to you. It was these girls.
It was these girls. It was these girls who had been through this, and having these faces and these voices that I was in direct contact with as representative of tens of thousands of children that were going through the same things that they went through.
There's also some description of Kony himself and the voices that spoke through him. Did that come from those girls, that information, or from other research?
I think some of it came from them. Some of it came from I read a lot of other oral accounts published by Human Rights Watch or different organizations. So that came from there. There were also accounts of ex-soldiers, you know, followers of Kony's, who would leave the group, and they would report on what was going on with Kony.
So you came back, you wrote this.
It was published in 2002.
So your last novel was published when you were busy working on this and shortly thereafter.
A little bit after, but I'd finished, yeah, it was a little bit after.
There was no novel in those 8 years. Now, during those 8 years, is that when you worked on the screenplay of Evening?
Yes, I did that. I was also writing a lot of poetry. I was doing some painting, and I was having a daughter.
But at the same time, you kind of knew in the back of your mind that your next book would be a novel based on your adventures, or how did that come about?
No, I really wasn't thinking. There was sort of 4 or 5 years in there when I thought I was not interested in writing a novel. I was interested in doing this other kind of writing. I think being a mother had something to do with that. And then when I did sort of return to the idea of writing another book. I had a few things in mind, different books I'd been sort of dreaming about a bit, but the one subject that was most in front of my face still was these girls. And I felt like their story was so compelling and it needed to be told.
And at the same time, Kony himself became kind of an internet meme at one point, which a lot of Africans were pretty upset about because it sort of showed American paternalism when it came down for Africa. So that kind of got in the way too, I guess.
It's funny, as I'm going around on book tour and talking about the LRA and Kony, people, you know, have this flicker of recognition, and Kony is not famous for being a warlord and a terror monger and a kidnapper and a rapist of children. He is known as the subject of a video that went famously viral. People did learn his name, which before that video, people didn't. So in that way, just as a flicker of recognition that there was some horrendous thing going on, that looked like it was headed in the right direction. But I don't know why it sort of dropped. I don't think people have a hard time responding empathetically. I really don't. I think that there are a lot of horrors that are thrown at them. And without knowing sort of what's really going on or having some connection to Africa or what country is this, it's hard for them to know what they can do to help.
Well, I think we're also in an ADD world, and today's news is tomorrow's forgotten history, and that must play a role, particularly when you're talking about YouTube.
Well, something replaces it immediately. So you may remember, but you're engaged in the next thing in front of your face.
Susan Minot, let's go back to the origins of this novel. So you finally figure, okay, here I've got this story I need to tell. It's a story that is going to be about how violence affects people, particularly these girls, but also white people, too, who have gone to Africa. But you have this idea. What is the next step? How do you get from that to the twin stories of Jane, the writer, coming to Africa and meeting Esther, one of the girls, and Esther's story herself?
Well, it started out like any long thing that you work on for 7 years. It goes through various evolutions, and you start in one direction and maybe drop something here and there and head off more in this direction. Originally, it was just going to be the story sort of more told from the inside out of these girls and their experience. And I had three sort of heroines, and I was going to follow each of them to explore the, you know, it's really more about how people cope with trauma more than what terrible violence is done to people, because that's a one-note sort of thing to explore. So I became interested in how, you know, and different people survive or not in different ways. So I was going to explore that. And then I realized, you know, there were horrible things going on there. And to depict that, you could only ask a reader to take it in so much. A little goes a long way. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just focus on one girl. And even with that, only this world of the rebels and the girls not knowing whether they're going to live or die each day, you know, it's harsh. So I thought maybe, and other reasons supported this, to have another story going on there that wasn't so dire, and maybe was one that certainly for a Western reader, there was a character who seemed like they could relate to her experience more.
She wound up taking up the bulk of the book, though. I mean, more than Esther. I mean, Esther's there.
Maybe in pages, but it's certainly not what most people talk about when they talk about the book. They talk more about Esther and that experience.
Well, her experience is primarily driving and touring and her relationship with one very young man. But, of course, then once you've done that, you can begin to go into themes of romantic relationship and sexuality that works through all of your books.
That interests me too, how people survive trauma inflicted by others and how people inflict trauma on themselves, perhaps, how love has a traumatic side.
How did you come to the idea that Jane's boyfriend would be like 20 years younger than her?
I wanted her to have a love affair that she quickly recognized was not something that was going to last a long time. So it would be an occasion for her to question what is the thing that draws you to someone. Usually the idea is, well, you're going to build something that will last a while. That seems to be the general prescriptive for people getting together. And so I didn't want that to be necessarily the reason.
That also opened up the fact that she's in Africa, it's temporary, and when you're in temporary situation of intensity, those things happen.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps with a different kind of intensity.
So you can contrast the different kinds of the intensity of the love affair versus the intensity of what these girls are going through.
I'd put it more that the intensity of Jane's struggle, whatever that is it looking for love? Is it looking for some meaning in her life, a place where she feels she's doing something worthwhile? I think that struggle maybe is what you might look at beside Esther's.
Susan Minot, the book is divided into three sections. The primary sections are first-person account by Esther, third-person close from the perspective of Jane, this writer coming to Uganda, and then there are these other sections called the U-File in second person. I understand that that was originally supposed to be where you'd be putting anecdotes, news reports, kind of what you call a Greek chorus, is that correct?
As I said, it evolved as I was doing it, and I wanted, maybe I was thinking of things that could be a relief from the Esther intensity of the violence, and so I thought about having the way things are reported from Africa, and so we could see it in contrast with maybe a more closer look at it, so that people could feel like, oh, this is what we're always hearing, and this is another version of how it is. The Greek chorus started to come in when it turned into the second person, because I was thinking of not only what Jane and Esther's experience, how they overlapped and what they had in common with each other, but maybe just the human experience overall. That's where the U-File.
And then Jane, meanwhile, travels around, meets a doctor in a hospital. Did you go to a hospital, see a doctor, have a similar experience too?
There is a hospital in the north called the Hospital at La Cour that served as, during this time when Kony and the LRA were terrorizing the north, as sort of refugee camp that each night people from nearby villages would come and to sleep inside the walls where it was safe. And I went to that hospital, yeah.
So even though, of course, you're not Jane, a lot of her reactions in the hospital, meeting these people, a lot of that is actually Susan Minot's reactions at the time.
The description of the place is what I saw there. The five characters that are traveling together, Jane and Pierre, and those may be sprinkled through them are some of my feelings and observations when I was there.
Did you take notes, a lot of notes at the time, much as Jane does?
I was, yes, because when I was there, I was writing this nonfiction, you know.
Did you
piece.
Go back to those notes for this novel?
I did a little, yep. Things that maybe didn't get into the other story.
One thing I noticed early on, and maybe it's just by accident, I was trying to get an image of people in my brain, and I noticed that it was very hard for me to figure out who was white and who was black. I guess that was probably quite deliberate on your part.
It was, yes. A friend of mine said, or I actually had an interview with someone who hadn't heard anything about the book and didn't even, I'm not sure he even read the blurb before. And he said the first, 20 pages, he didn't realize that it was in Africa because they are Italian nuns and they are sort of Christian name. You know, there isn't these flags that say Africa, which I think pushes people away from it. And I was trying to bring people closer to it.
I also noticed in that regard, some of the sequences in Kenya are described in such a way that if we didn't know it was Kenya, it would feel almost like an American town.
That's good. The landscape and the place is actually very important in the book, but not in a, I would say, more in a geographical way than a cultural way.
Well, it also creates a greater sense of us to see the comparison between life in Kenya and life in Uganda.
Yes, that is something that struck me when I took this trip to what was ostensibly a kind of war-like situation, that it was very close in proximity to people water skiing on the lake, on Lake Victoria in Kampala.
And in fact, that's one of the more stunning moments in the book. They're just hanging out by a lake, and it could be anywhere, and nearby, children are being kidnapped, and people are being murdered.
Well, I don't think that's only true of Africa.
You talked a moment ago, you talked about trauma. And in an interview, you quoted a piece from War and Peace. What, in your mind, is the relationship of that segment of War and Peace to this book?
It's the section when Pierre has been taken prisoner and he's marching back to Moscow as a prisoner. And his shoes are full of holes, and he's in the snow, and people are being shot daily. You know, it's pretty much at the bottom of a difficult existence. And he makes the observation in that situation that the suffering that he feels there, he has this revelation about it, that it's relative, that he's suffering in a way just as much as he did when he put on his tight dancing shoes because it was an affront to something he didn't want to do or because he was distressed or anxious. He talks about the adaptability of the human, how amazingly he will adjust to that. I think people are incredible creatures. And maybe one thing that they do that is not so admirable is they have often a sort of moral measure of suffering, which I think that's not right.
When I've spoken with African writers who are writing about Africa, they relate what's going on now to post-colonialism, to the legacy of colonialism. In a book like 30 Girls, it's not quite as evident. Where do you see that post-colonial world cropping up in the story in a way that maybe not isn't as evident when you read it?
Well, it's certainly the East Africa, the Kenyans that Jane meets they're a product of that colonial history in Kenya.
There's a point toward the end of the book when Harry, her boyfriend, who we've learned was white, he mentions the fact that he only knew white people growing up. Is that something you found over there?
He actually says that he didn't only know white people. His closest friend was the son of his family's servant. So it was his good friend, a black boy, but then once he grew up, it wasn't as easy to have black friends. And that's just something I observed in my experience over there.
You didn't go back for this trip, did you, for this book?
Not while I was writing it. I did not go back.
Have you gone back since?
I was there actually at Christmas for a very, very brief trip. Not to Uganda, but just Kenya.
Did you see differences between then and almost 20 years ago?
I did, a little. I was really there for 10 days, so it was... and part of it, I was on the beach.
So how does Kenya feel today to you?
It feels very anxious. It feels like it's got a lot of troubles. It's full of strong and positive people, but some people are messing things up badly. Where things were headed 20 years ago, it may not have looked as volatile, but the same inequalities and the same corruption was going on then. It just wasn't as evident as it is now, I think.
Susan Minot, I'd like to talk a little about your career. You always wanted to be a writer, one of those people, right?
Well, I actually never really wanted to be a writer. I just wanted to write. I didn't want to write. I just did write. I wasn't very practically minded, so I wasn't thinking, what am I going to be when I grow up? I just followed what I liked to do.
At what point did you realize maybe you had something saleable?
It wasn't really that. It was more that probably in my mid-20s, I thought, this is something I'm doing all the time. I'm going to have to make a living, and it's not going to be painting houses and waitressing forever. So maybe I should see if I can kind of parlay this thing that I do all the time into a job.
And at that point, you'd already written several stories, correct?
I had, yes.
So you picked one and just sent it out?
Well, I had been sending, I had sent things out since college just to sort of see if I could get something in print. So I'd been doing that kind of all along.
What was the breakthrough? The New Yorker? Where did you get your first story?
Well, my first story was published at a literary magazine called Grand Street, which was an amazing magazine that went on for 10 years, I think, was its legacy. Run by a man named Ben Sonnenberg, who bought the story. It ended up being the first story in Monkeys. And the letter of acceptance, I remember it to this day, it said, I would like to publish your short story Hiding in the whatever number issue of Grand Street if you will delete the line on page 11 about the bomb shelter. So I said, okay.
How much did they pay you?
I think I got maybe $1,000, because Ben Sonnenberg had inherited money from his father in a philanthropic trust. So he shifted that and thought, I'll have a literary magazine where I can actually pay people. And there I actually got a job at Grand Street, which the staff was Ben Sonnenberg, his designer, Deborah Thomas, and whatever editorial assistant that they had, which is me for a while. And I worked there, and I sent my next story to The New Yorker.
How did that first book, Monkeys, get published then?
Well, so I had published this story in Grand Street and one other one in The New Yorker. Both stories had as the characters this family called the Vincents. And I had more ideas for this Vincent family. They resembled in some way my own. So I had a number of stories. So I had a few sort of in process, and I met the legendary publisher Seymour Lawrence, who we knew as Sam Lawrence. Someone introduced me in New York, I think it was at a reading, at a bookstore, and my introduction was Susan just sold her first story to The New Yorker. So that was a good intro, and his eyes kind of lit up, and he said, well, do you have anything else? And I said, yes. And I showed him these three family stories, and he offered me a contract for a novel. And I said, I only write short stories. I don't think I can write a novel. So we crossed out novel, and a work of fiction is what we put in the contract. But as I was writing these stories, even though I kept the form of the short story for each one, I started to think of it because I knew they were all going to be together in a book. So I do call it a novel now because I was thinking where it fit into the larger story, even as I kept it as a...
And so you continued to write short stories. Was Folly the first actual novel then?
I think Monkeys was, but that was the one that started out to be a novel at the beginning.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you feel about taking on the bigger project at the time? Was it kind of scary?
It was just as big a project to me. A book is a book. I think Folly even is, you know, I have the chapters and they're called different headings, and even within the chapters there are different. I still think of it as made up of little stories.
And Evening has that same feel to it,
mm-hmm,
as well.
It's my brick.
How'd you get involved with Bertolucci on Stealing Beauty?
A friend of mine was writing a profile of him, and he asked her, she was an American writer named Fernanda Eberstadt. He had an idea, the protagonist of his movie idea was an American or an English young woman. And he asked her if she would want to write it for him. And she said that she did not think she had any feeling for writing for films, but that she had an American writer friend who was in love with cinema, and maybe I'd be interested. He knew Monkeys. I think it was published in Italy and got a lot of attention there then.
Did you work on your own and then work with him? Did you go over and sit in a room and just bandy about ideas? How did that work?
He gave me two sentences. That was his idea. And he said, a young American or English girl goes to Tuscany to visit English expatriates who live there. Sentence one. Sentence two, she's a virgin on a mission to lose her virginity. Sentence two, which sort of lost my interest, I think, a little. I thought, oh, no, it would be a dream to work with Bertolucci, but I'm not sure if I could get behind that as sort of a concept. But we discussed it further, and his interest had more to do with bafflement. He had heard of a situation like that, and he, as he said to me, couldn't understand what was possibly going on in the mind of a girl with that intent.
So at that point you go, aha.
Well, I said, I don't think I can either, but I know what goes on in the mind of a girl, so I can help you there. That was my first screenplay, but the first thing I gave him, he said, well, can you write a treatment? And I've never really understood how you write a treatment without writing it seems like the boiled-down version of the long thing you write. So I wrote a sort of mishmash between, I said, well, I really write short stories. It was sort of a short story, but with a kind of pitching. You know, it was a horrible piece of writing. But he got enough of an idea that he, you know, we had a picture, we had sort of three acts, we had a bunch of characters. And then I went back to him with that, and he said, well, I would actually like in this house where all these people meet different nationalities. And I, okay, so I went back and I made a Frenchman.
As this is growing, when you're writing a novel or short story, frequently what happens, you know, we put it in quote, characters start acting on their own. And we kind of see it in 30 Girls. Did that happen with writing the screenplay too?
I know writers always say that characters start acting on their own, but I've never seen that happen. The characters don't do anything unless I write the words to make them do that. Sometimes your book can go in a direction that you didn't envision when you were on page 10. You're not quite exactly sure what's going to be going on at 200, but by the time you get up there, whatever happens on 200 is only what you write. A movie is very different.
Yeah.
Because a screenplay is a blueprint for another form. And that form is one that is made of images flickering on a screen. It's made of actual sound. It's made of actors inhabiting characters. So the control is not the same at all.
Well, in a book like 30 Girls, Susan Minot, in a book like that, toward the end of the book, when you actually understand perfectly well who Harry is and who Jane is, and you put them together, they're going to do things and write things. I mean, it's always you, obviously. But on some level, things can happen that will still surprise you, don't they? Or not? They happen to a lot of writers.
I know. That's what they say. I don't. I mean, it's not that it's surprising. It's that you go a place that you hadn't envisioned until you get there. But you are there. They're not somewhere else that you're not. You're there before they're there.
What's really interesting for me, that when I talk to different people and ask them around that question, I get so many different answers.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a combination of conscious and unconscious control going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You always are writing, and yet at the same time, things happen.
Let's hopefully, yeah. Bertolucci talked about having an open door in cinema because since it was actually people acting, you know, in the moment, and instead of having it all totally mapped out, he liked the feeling that a little life could come entering in. And certainly, you know, you want that feeling in a book. It's not all prescribed before. In fact, E.L. Doctorow, who said that writing was like, and even if you knew what the story's going to happen, you only see as far, driving in a car at night, and you only see as far as the headlights are in front of you. So suddenly, oh, you're going to turn here, and maybe you didn't know you're going to have a turn, but when you get there, you see you must turn. And you're driving the car.
My one unpublished novel, there was a point where people are running. I wrote, and then they hit a boulder. It's like, and I guess that's what happened.
Yes, but you made that happen.
I made
that happen. The boulder didn't come out of nowhere.
But then I'm going, okay, what are they going to do now? The movie, Stealing Beauty, how did you feel about it when you finally saw it?
I was very involved. I was at the set, and we would rewrite the scene to the next day, depending on how things had gone that day, or adjusting some to the actors. Liv Tyler, who was the star, has this exuberance about her, and the character I had written was much more closed, and it seemed a shame not to use some of this exuberance. So we wrote that sort of in more. And we would watch the rushes every day, and I saw different edits and a few sort of final edits, and I was always very, very excited watching them. And the very, I think, very last final film didn't have the same punch. Maybe because it was done.
An evening, did Michael Cunningham approach you about that?
Oh, no. No, I had done a lot of drafts on my own for the producers that were doing it, Jeff Sharp and John Hart. I would say my movie writing style is more toward the innovative than the kind of standard, and I think they were looking for more of a standard kind of adaptation. So they went to another writer to work on it. It was in succession, so we did not work together.
Have you written other screenplays then that haven't been turned into films?
No.
How do you feel about it? You want to write another one, or are you done?
I'm planning on writing one for 30 Girls. It's been optioned by Rachel Weisz. And she wants to play Jane Wood.
Susan Minot, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a collection of stories set on an island in Maine.
Have any of them been published yet?
Actually, a couple of them were published 10 years ago. And again, I didn't know they were going to be a part of this sort of group, but they fit into it.
Is it going to wind up being kind of a novelish thing like Monkeys, or don't you know yet?
No.
Separate?
Yeah. It's going to be more Winesburg, Ohio.
Finishing up, what's the story with Coney now, since you've been on top of that? What's the story with his army, his Lord's Resistant Army?
Well, apparently he's got no more of a group than a couple of hundred, which sounds like a lot, but there were thousands when he was really active. He's no longer in Uganda. The sort of latest intelligence is that he's in Central African Republic. And just recently, Obama sent over some more troops to try to catch him. And they fly out of Uganda every day with the Ugandan army, the UPDF, and they're looking for him.
You've been listening to an interview with Susan Minot, whose latest novel is 30 Girls. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.